Thanks for tuning in to the Roundtable Podcast, episode 27.
Hello, everyone. I'm Brian Humphrey.
And I'm Dave Robison.
And you're listening to the Roundtable Podcast.
Each week on the Roundtable Podcast, Brian and I invite writers to come onto the show and present story ideas to us and our esteemed guest host.
And then we tear it open like a nice shiny new present and take it apart and put it back together and hopefully have some pieces left over that we can toss aside and see what we can do with it and shine it up into what Dave likes to call...
literary gold.
That's right.
Literary I love the birthday gold. Present metaphor. That's brilliant. But I know why you're in present mode.
You do?
I do. You just got some very cool news.
Yes, we did.
Share.
And it came in the form of two cakes because my wife wanted to do a reveal the gender party for our twins. And so she cut into the first cake and we could see a little pink glow. And so we're definitely having a girl. And then I cut into the other cake and there was a nice little blue glow. So... we are having one of each, and that's
Wait. This is prognostication? Like you're cutting open bird guts and divining what your child's genders are?
Well, there has to be cakes? Some kind of magic thrown in, you know, in some way. Yeah. But, you know, there's a website called CakeRex.com.
Okay.
And they actually have pictures of cakes where people have had cakes made that look like a baby that has just been delivered.
Dude.
As their reveal cake, and then they cut into it, and that's a little too far for me.
See,
so ours were just white with purple writing, and that's all.
Good, yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm glad you went that route.
Yeah. Yeah.
And thanks for putting that image in our heads. Okay. Awesome. Let's jeté away from that, shall we?
Let's do that.
But yeah. Congratulations, bud. That's awesome
news.
You are going to be a fabulous, fabulous father. No, it's true. And I expect your children to be on the show early in their development. So
yes.
We'll do children's books workshops. But for now, today, no children's books.
No.
No, today we're going for grown-up books and some very cool grown-up books. But in order to do that, we need a guest host to help guide us through these treacherous, treacherous waters. So, dear friends, please welcome back to the large chair at the round table, the vice president of the SFWA, Hugo-nominated author, Nebula Award-winning author, as well as Hugo's in World Fantasy and all kinds of awesomeness. Ladies and gentlemen, Rachel Swirsky. Rachel, thanks for coming back to the round table. We appreciate it.
It's great to be here.
So, Rachel, I know that with the Hugos coming up, you've got World Fantasy staring you in the face. If you would share with our listeners for a little bit, what else is coming up in Rachel Swirsky's world?
Yes, I will be at WorldCon. I'm actually not going to World Fantasy this year because I'm lazy and not going to travel very far.
Okay.
But I may be in Colorado for Mile High Con. I'm also considering going to OriCon, which is the same weekend as World Fantasy and in Portland.
A little closer to home.
You know, at WorldCon, I will be there also as the vice president of CIFWA. So that's a good time to bug me if you need to bug me. And you can also send your ire or questions to me via email.
Do you get a lot of ire?
I haven't gotten much yet.
Oh, good.
But, you know, ire, horse's heads.
All sorts of metaphorical gifts that could be interpreted multiple ways.
I also do have some publications coming up. I've got a story coming up on tor.com soon, which I'm excited about. It's about fictional Renaissance painters. And I'm going to write a piece on that for Mary Robinette Qual's blog for a new feature she's doing called My Favorite Bit.
Excellent.
And I'm really excited. I had a story just come out in an anthology from Haikasoru, which is an American press that translates Japanese work.
Wow.
It's their first original collection, and they got half stories by Japanese authors that are translated and half stories by American authors, and it's called The Future is Japanese, and I think it's pretty awesome. So.
Now, is your work going to be translated into Japanese, and then for the are they going to do a Japanese imprint and then translate accordingly?
Nobody's asked me for it yet. I think my Nebula Award-winning story has been translated into Japanese, but I don't think Haikasoru is doing it.
Okay. I can see your work translating beautifully into Japanese.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's true.
Awesome. Very cool. So just to recap, Mile High Con. Brian, did you catch that? Mile High Con?
I've already looked it up, and I'm the problem is that like it's right the weekend that the twins are probably going to come.
Where are your priorities, young man?
It's the universe hates me, is what it is.
Rachel, Brian was lamenting that there aren't a lot of cons in his area, and you're the second author we've had on the show who has referenced Mile High Con as the place to be. So we're hoping.
Yeah, there's lots of good Colorado authors who are there. Carrie Vaughn and, Daniel Abraham.
Awesome.
Awesome.
I wanted to ask, are there any plans of any of your work being done audibly? Being translated into audio format anytime soon?
I've had a bunch of stories on Escape Pod and Podcastle. And I had one a few months ago that was on Starship Sofa. And they also did Lady Who Plucked Red Flowers last year. And I think I have one upcoming with Podcastle, which is Memory of Wind, which was nominated for the Nebula Award in 2010.
Okay. So you're just one pod away from the trifecta.
Oh, she's got one on Pseudopod, right?
Actually. Oh, you got Pseudopod? Oh, you've done it. Yeah. Awesome. That's great. That's a very elite group of authors who have achieved the trifecta. Well done.
Well, thank you. I also used to edit Podcastle, so.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. I noticed that in your bio.
But I didn't publish myself.
Right. 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 Yes. And we would not expect that of you.
No.
But what we do expect of you, Rachel, is to lend a hand with the workshopping of a story. Are you prepared for this arduous task?
Oh yeah, it sounds terrible, but I'll steal myself for it.
Excellent. We'll all steel ourselves for the onslaught. No, this is the best part. But before we do that, we need to pause briefly to showcase another awesome podcast or some fabulous audio fiction. So we'll pause for a promotional break. When we come back, we'll introduce our guest writer and get down to workshopping a story. Sound good?
Let's do it to it.
Awesome. All right, friends, stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Rashim the Hunter killed the beast. The keepers kept the legend alive. The Macedonians uncovered the ancient book. And now, in the Library of Alexandria, the greatest storehouse of human knowledge, one scribe discovers the truth about the god Garaga. This is not a legend. Scrolls, Volume 4 in Paul Ellard Cooley's Garaga's Children Saga, ties together the previous tales in a fiery conclusion. Now available as an ebook from all major retailers, a full-length audiobook, and as a free serialized audiobook from shadowpublications.com. We don't believe in happy endings.
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen, and we're off to a really good start. We've got Rachel Swirsky with us, and there's a story coming up that is just going to be phenomenal, and this is always my favorite part of the podcast. So, Dave, let's get into it.
Oh, absolutely. We cannot have the Roundtable Podcast without a courageous guest writer willing to put the offer their story up for discussion and consideration.
That's right.
And our guest writer today, it's just beyond awesome, was one of the original co-hosts of the Dead Robot Society for the first 2 years of the show. And he interviewed a long and talented list of creators and authors, both from the podosphere and beyond. In addition to his work on that show, did numerous voiceover roles. When you hear his voice, you'll find out why. For podcast novels, fiction-based shows, including Dead Hunt, Guild of the Coward Catchers. We just had Abigail Hilton on. She was fabulous. Angel Between the Lines and a veritable host, a cornucopia of others. As an author, his first work, a supernatural western, will be available through digital self-published means sometime by the end of the year, and we're all anticipating that. He lives in Waterloo, Canada, Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. He assists with Taekwondo, I'm told. I've heard it both ways. Plays drums and bass, though he claims not to be able to do it at the same time. Works in the IT industry. Most notably, he does not like long walks on the beach. He hates sand in his shoes. That's just really all there is to it. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Skype line, Mr. Ryan Stevenson. Ryan, thank you so much, man, for offering up a story. We so appreciate it.
Hey, no worries. How could I not? How could I not?
Indeed, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
So, Ryan, you have a long and distinguished history in the literary pursuits as well as other creative pursuits. How did that get fostered in you, sir?
Mom told me to get a hobby. And she told me that, I think, once every 3 to 4 weeks, pick a quieter hobby. Started with drums, get a quieter hobby, move to bass, you know, just kept going and going until finally the scratching of pen on paper was about the decibel level she could deal with. it's really just been a natural transition from one thing to the next. I've done acting, I've done stand-up comedy, I've done everything possible to explore creativity in any means that I can. And it always seems like there's a very easy transition from one to the next. It's that old adage, though, of course, that I am experienced with many things, but a master of none.
Yes.
But I think that's a good place to be. I don't think that phrase is something that we should look down on. So I've had a lot of good fortune in my life. And, you know, writing is just, it's been there the whole time, really. That's been the component to it.
I completely agree. The Renaissance artist is definitely something. Well, and obviously Rachel is an advocate of that as well. So, and Brian and I as well. So we're certainly all on the same page as far as that goes. Mm-hmm. And Ryan, you've brought a story for consideration. Have you not, sir?
Oh, I've brought a story, yeah. Crucial consideration to be had, yes, absolutely.
Awesome. Awesome. Yes. Very cool. Then we will turn the mic over to you, sir. You have 5 to 8 minutes. Give us title, genre, format. Is it going to be a novel, a novella, short story, whatever? And give us character, story, all the goodness. The mic, sir, is all yours.
Wonderful. Well, the story itself is called After Life, and if I had to define it, it's a novel. It is a supernatural horror story with just a bit of a detective thriller peppered into it. It's the story of a defeated spirit guide living in the world between life and death who has to step out of a stagnant world and take action to resolve the circumstances of a young woman's reincarnation before the spirits of the world of death rip everything he knows and all those in it to pieces. Thematically, and as with a lot of my stories, it's about the importance of taking action and inflicting change to defy whatever defined as fate is. Specifically in terms of my protagonist, this is a story about the weight that self-sacrifice should carry and the value in choosing to stand up for something you believe in, even when the easy route is to stay the course and stay safe. The story itself is set in three worlds, the world we know it as the land of the living, the world we know as the afterlife, but most importantly, there's a spirit world between the afterlife and life known as midlife. In this land exist the spirits and souls of people whose bodies have died, but their minds or souls haven't come to terms with the truth of their death. They're bound enough to their stubborn beliefs that they're still alive, be it that this is a hallucination or a fantasy, that they're not dead, that they can pass on, and their spirit can't move to the afterlife until they accept that truth wholly and truthfully. When that happens, though, their spirits passes on to the afterlife and to whatever waits for them there. More temporally speaking, afterlife takes place in the early 90s just because I love that time period, and I believe that that does a good job of taking technology out as a catalyst, and it forces my hero to use more conventional detective means. In other words, he can't Google anything at this point. It focuses on a character named Charlie. He's been in the midlife for a lot longer than most of the other spirits there, and unlike most of those spirits, he's come to terms with the fact that he's dead. So the question is, why hasn't he moved on? Something is keeping him pinned to the midlife, and he's resigned himself to that fate, and he bides his time by helping the spirits of other people who've recently died come to terms with that death before what's known as a shade comes to get their claws into them. For Charlie, this task of guiding spirits to the reality of their deaths has kind of made him detached. He's cold. He's got no sympathy. He doesn't really have the ability to connect with these spirits, and he just sort of goes through the motions with no hope or ambition. But he's not a quitter, and he doesn't complain about the cards he's been dealt. He's just convinced that the worst is happening to him and there's nothing he can do for it. This is his self-inflicted penance for something he must have done in real life. Another character of import here is Michelle, who's a teenager that was just finding her way in real life before she died. She's innocent, but she's not ignorant. I think there's a very clear definition there. She comes from a family of wealth and virtue, but she wanted to carve her own path to success and get what she wanted on her own merits. She was full of ambition. She was full of drive. She had a promising future. And then, of course, the unthinkable happened. When she meets Charlie, she's a tougher case than normal simply because she can't remember anything about her death at all, which is a little uncharacteristic. A third character of important note here is Charlie's real-life daughter named Rebecca. She's in her 30s, and when Charlie died, she didn't know that. She still clings to the belief that her father is alive somewhere out there in the world. Unbeknownst to Charlie, it is Rebecca's belief that he is still alive that is keeping him pinned to the midlife. That's a key point that'll come up halfway through the story. As long as she believes he's alive, he stays in the midlife. I mentioned, or I alluded to, shades earlier. They're kind of an environmental hazard that I've added into the story that'll escalate as something of a shadowy tornado, for lack of a better way to put it. They're representatives of the afterlife, and they're callous and they're vicious, and they torture the souls of those in the midlife, forcing them to believe that they've died so that their soul can make that transition, but they do it in terrible and vicious and horrific ways. It violently rips that soul from the midlife and pitches it into the afterlife. Of course, the next question is, who's the antagonist? And I've got a big old question mark there, because that's, I think, where a lot of this conversation is going to have to focus. The antagonist is a very large gray area for me. As far as the story goes, it begins when Michelle dies and she arrives in the midlife, and Charlie takes to his task helping her come to terms with that death before the shades come and get her. It proves difficult because, again, she doesn't remember dying. But as he's making leeway into helping her come to terms with being dead, her spirit vanishes. That could be a good thing if it went to the afterlife, but in this case, there's a twist. She actually goes back to the land of the living. She's reincarnated, or she is, as I like to put it, reverse murdered. It's a violation of the natural state of things, and when she returns to life, those shades that police the midlife take it upon themselves to become that literal tornado and wash over the midlife, harvesting as many souls as they can and pushing them into the afterlife. When Charlie sees this happening, he knows that Michelle's the catalyst, and he resolves that he's got to do something to change it. But his only real way to do that is to return himself to the land of the living. The only way he can do that is with the help of poltergeists and reincarnation of his own, or possession into a comatose body. So here's a guy who's been dead for 20 years, and now all of a sudden he appears in a hospital bed and has to learn how to move muscles, how to blink, how to breathe. In that body with him, there's a key point, is the owner of that body, who very much does not want Charlie there, and there's an internal mental conflict that happens there. This character, who has very loose definition, and I need help with this as well, is not a good and noble person, but has been comatose for far too long and is jealous of Charlie's ability to control his body and wants to manipulate Charlie's soul to help him in turn control his body again. Charlie struggles on to find out what happened to Michelle. How did she get reverse murdered? How did she get reincarnated? And what should happen? During that investigation, he encounters his daughter, Rebecca, and he has an opportunity to convince her that he is actually dead, even though she obviously doesn't know it is him. If he does that, if he takes that easy opportunity, then he gets to go to the afterlife, which is what he's been wanting all along. But he also can't resolve Michelle's story, and therefore leaves the midlife in whatever state it is in right now. So naturally, he's not going to make that choice, because it wouldn't be a very heroic one if he did. He struggles on, mindful of that fate that the midlife suffers, and when he encounters Michelle, he thinks he's got an opportunity to resolve it, until the big moment comes and he realizes that the proper resolution here is for him to kill Michelle, to return her where she belongs. But can he do that? Can a good person take a life if it means preserving the souls in the midlife, or is he forced to inaction? That's in question as well for right now. As it stands right now, I have a lot of possible endings in the way that that'll turn out, but I think that's going to come out of this conversation as well. Or if another way to put it is, at this point, with much of the story, I don't know how this ends. And that's where I'm at.
And that's why awesome. You're here.
Oh, that's yeah. Right. Oh, yeah. There's a lot of gray area here.
Awesome pitch, Rye. Awesome pitch. Well done,
yeah.
Sir.
Yeah.
All right. So you've given us some signposts to shoot for. The antagonist is certainly a question. Mm-hmm. How the story ends is a question. Is there anything else from this conversation that you're really hoping that we address, or that we touch on in some way?
I think a lot of it's going to come organically out of the conversation as we talk. I know that the antagonist is such a huge component, and it's going to have such a big impact on theme and tone, that I expect the conversation will hover heavily in those tangents as we get there. Okay. I think the same would be said of this this character who exists in the body that Charlie takes over as well. I should point out I'm not excluding the possibility that he too is the antagonist, but I am very anti-convenience in my stories if I can avoid it.
Okay.
And I feel like that would be an easy answer. So cool. Yeah, to really long answer to your very simple question is no, I haven't. I want to let this happen organically, so I'm just going to kind of grab onto the handlebars and see if the bike gets me to the bottom of the hill or not.
Well, sweet. Let's push that bike over the hill and see how fast we can get up to. But first, Brian, cover our butts, bud, and give the disclaimer, if you would be so kind.
Absolutely. So, Ryan, you have brought us a fascinating story. And in the course of this workshopping, myself, Dave, Rachel, we are all going to be throwing a lot of ideas at you and sort of reworking things. And you have absolutely every right to regard any and everything that we say as complete and total bullshit.
Okay.
So don't feel like you have to do anything that we suggest.
Absolutely. Okay. This is your story. We're just here to play in your sandbox for a little bit.
And I do appreciate you all taking the time to do that. This is pretty gnarly.
It's going to be fun. Rachel, we always defer to our guest host for first impressions, points of clarification and questions. So at this point, start us off. What was your impression of Rye's story idea? Any questions that you have? Lead us into the discussion.
It seems to me that you've got some really good pacing, and I mean, I haven't read the actual text, but the plot as you described it to us seems really well paced through the beginning, and it seems like you've taken lots of really interesting choices with the plot. Like, I would definitely keep reading with this set of questions, even though you haven't figured out what's going on later. Mm-hmm. So that makes me happy.
Makes me happy. That's good news. It's two of us.
And protagonist, is he also the person who, or she, who resurrected Michelle?
It's interesting you would mention that. When I originally thought of this, yes, he was. But then I started toying around with the idea that he didn't necessarily have to be. So the answer is shrug. Could be, maybe not. I think if he were the person that both killed and resurrected her, it's going to be a tough sell for me as an author to come up with a valid reason why anyone would do that.
So now, Michelle was murdered. I had missed that, I think.
No, not even for sure. I mean, again, that's sort of where my mind keeps going when I think about this myself, but maybe it is just a simple accident. I think it really depends on that antagonist's course of action and why he's doing this, and that's why he is such an important gray area for me to fill, or she, I shouldn't say he, to fill in before I can really proceed and start answering those questions. Yeah, because I need to know him before I know why he'd do what he would do.
And Rachel, one of the things that we do on the podcast is everyone has free rein to invoke what if explore different possibilities. Okay, so what if Michelle was murdered, blah blah blah, and go down that road a little bit and see where it takes us creatively.
My instinct, and this is usually my instinct with characters like antagonists, is to look at the way that they might actually not be an antagonist, but somebody who simply has a different conflicting motivations. And it seems to me that you've actually got a lot of room, especially if it's the same person who kills her and then revives her. If it's somebody who loves her or even somebody who just can't deal with the fact that they killed someone, they could easily think they were doing a good thing by bringing her back to life. And in fact, enlisting that person's help might be one of the ways to kill Michelle. One of the other things that I'm thinking about is you could ask Michelle what she wants to do. I'm a big fan of that as a resolution to stories where one character needs to die for the good of everyone, is to be like, okay, well, this is going on, and it's kind of on you, not on me.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
That's a very good point. When I started writing up the synopsis here, one of the funny thing that happened was as I was typing the synopsis out to discuss this on this very episode, I found my hands just kept hammering out different sentences, and then I'd kill it and rewrite it and kill it and rewrite it. And one of the things that came up was that Michelle at the end would make the decision to be that hero and to step up and do the right thing for these spirits in the midlife. So that's still on the table too. Jeez. And that's a great point. I appreciate you bringing that up. It's my only concern with that was that it felt like it took the catalyst for resolving the story out of Charlie's hands. And that's not necessarily true, but it just felt like, you know, it didn't seem heroic for him to walk up to someone and say, you know, you should probably kill yourself to save these souls, for lack of a better way to put it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think there are ways to handle that. One way would be giving him a really, really strong motivation not to tell her. If he doesn't want her to die, for some reason he's become very connected to her as a living person. Or he sees what her future is going to be, and it's, you know, so unfair for her to die. She reminds him of Rebecca, whatever it is. But I often usually, do you know the screenwriting plot arc?
Not well.
You start with exposition, then you have the moment when the characters can't leave the plot line, like they're dedicated to the adventure. Then in the middle, usually you have a reversal. In Jaws, it's like, or when Harry met Sally, will they get together? And then can they stay together? It was another sort of hook like that at the end. And what I usually do if I'm plotting something like this and I have two really strong characters is you might have Michelle make that decision and then have him have to do something else to help her make that decision, to convince her, something else that he has to do in order to enable her to do it. I mean, he still has to hold the knife. I think that as the plot develops, that's not insurmountable. You just have to add other things that he can do.
Good. Excellent.
Yeah.
Let's continue around the table for first impressions. Brian, what are your first thoughts and impressions for Rye's idea?
Oh boy. I'm trying to figure out which one to like go with because I've got a bunch and I don't want to, you know. okay. One thing, since we were kind of talking about antagonists, and this was something that comes up from time to time, I wonder, you know, because I'm so heavily antagonist, is does the antagonist actually need to be a person or an entity? Or can it be something like in Neverending Story where it was the nothing? Or time, you know, where his major, the biggest conflict that he has is getting this done within a certain time. While it goes against what his, when he was alive, what his human morality and ethics were, and that decision, do I kill her or not? Because I think you put a lot of emphasis on that aspect as to whether or not he can bring himself to actually kill her to right whatever wrong has been going on. And so I don't know that you necessarily have to have a specific person that you can point to and say, that is the antagonist. And I was talking to Dave about this, and I was using Stephen King's 11/22/63 as kind of an example. And in that book, time or the past is the antagonist. You know, there are a few bad guys, but the main antagonist seems to be the past that consistently steps in his way. And so you can kind of make it a character that is malleable or that does things that are sort of
have a name or a
right.
personality, you know, nature.
Yeah, doesn't have any kind of physical characteristic attached to it. It just is this thing that keeps getting in his way. So that was one thing. And then I just have some questions. One of them is, how does Charlie evade the shades? If he's kind of stuck in midlife, what is it about him that, because it seems like he's kind of immune to them. Is that true?
Yeah, that is true. And I had to sort of temper how much of the world building I threw into the synopsis, but I'm glad you brought that up. He and others like him who are pinned, if I'm doing air quotes here, so I wish there was video.
it's okay. We heard it.
The air quotes.
Yeah, there you go.
It was well done.
Those who are pinned versus those who are there by the conventional means, which is they don't believe they're dead. The people that are pinned are, for whatever reason, undetectable. And he's not the only one like that. I very briefly mentioned with the help of poltergeists, he gets reincarnated, and I see them as being the same kind of thing. One of the things that came up when I've had this conversation with Terry and Justin from the show was that physical objects can have just as much of an emotional context as a person can have. So I could conceptually have, you know, an object pinning a person or something to that effect. So yes, he is immune to the shades, by virtue of the fact that Rebecca is the catalyst for keeping him here.
Okay.
And I want to segue too, because if you don't mind, you did inspire a thought in me too that has come up as I've thought about this, was the idea that as he's returned to life, for whatever reason, Rebecca is starting to finally come to terms with the fact he's dead, which does put a nice, awesome little clock on everything he does.
There you go.
Right.
That's fabulous. The shades attacking, sure.
Yeah.
Right. And then I just have two more very quick questions. One is, is Michelle in someone else's body when she goes back, or is she back in her own?
I've always pictured her back in her own body.
Okay. So that may be a problem.
In a coffin underground?
Right. That's
not necessarily, because I see no reason that the flow of time for a soul would be the same as the flow of time for a flesh and blood body.
Okay.
All right. I can go with that. And then the only other question, and this is a really fast one, is The title, I'm drawn to it, but mm-hmm. I'm wondering why it isn't midlife, because it seems like that's so much more the focus than actually the afterlife. We don't really deal with the afterlife much.
Yeah, else. And I have a confession to make. I worked at a movie store for a very long time. This will be a quick story. And you remember the movie Castaway with Tom Hanks?
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah, it's actually two words. Cast away, not castaway. And I always used to tell people there's a very different meaning between the title if you think of it as cast away and castaway. And the same thing applies here. I thought I would call it midlife, and then I thought that doesn't have the right tone to me. And then when I wrote out afterlife, I'm a programmer, so I did camel notation, big L. I saw the two words and thought, you know what? That speaks to what this is about for me.
Okay.
So it's not set in stone, but it's kind of one of those dirty little, look at me, I'm so witty and ha 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 type things.
No, it works. Because it is. It's what happens to Charlie after life. Mm-hmm. No, that's perfect.
Not necessarily in the afterlife, but
right.
Exactly. That's life. What we're working with.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like that a lot. Yeah. That's okay. Good answer, Ryan.
Okay. For myself, right, the first thing I got to ask is what kind of story are you envisioning here? And what I'm asking is you're playing kind of fast and loose with life, death, all of that. And this is really a story, Rachel, Michelle, the supernatural underpinnings almost seem, as they have been presented so far, conventional, not conventional, convenient, that's the word, as mere frail supports to get this character story out there. It's almost more literary fiction than genre fiction. And I wanted to ask, are you looking to beef up the genre aspect of this, or are you looking to tell a much more character-driven story with the supernatural stuff kind of shoved into the background?
I will answer none of the questions for the remainder of this episode in a straightforward fashion, so heads up. I feel like the answer I want to give is I'm looking to make this more genre, because I think that will entertain people more, but I know myself, and I'm going to end up driving this pretty heavy towards the character side, because that's what's important to me as a storyteller.
Then that's the way we should go.
Yeah.
And friends, I suggest we go there. So the other observation I had is with the story arc as you presented it, have you tried to write this as a short story as opposed to a novel?
No, I haven't actually.
And Rachel, of course, you inspired that particular observation, but I'm looking at the arc and I'm going, you know, there's some good stuff here, but I'm not sure there's a novel here in terms of the events that are unfolding. And as Rachel has pointed out, you know, the intensity, the passion, the immediacy of that short format might really serve to wet your pen nib, as it were, for how things unfold. Plus, you can rewrite it 16 or 17 times, and it'll be awesome. Yeah. Yep.
I think a lot of that depends on where you are in the process. I got the impression when you were talking about this that maybe this is something you have the first 20,000 words written, but you haven't entirely sketched out the outline for.
I'd say I'm at about 10,000 words, but I think they're easily abandoned, is the way to put that. I'm not comfortable diving into the pool without knowing how deep it is, for lack of a better way to put it. And then on a friend's advice, I tried to write this without an outline, and I couldn't do it. I don't even need a concrete outline that says scene, but I need to have some of these answers before I can feel comfortable guiding the story.
Sure.
So I secretly believe that you can basically tell any story at any length.
True.
So if you want to do it as a novel, it just needs more reversals and more threats. You have a lot of potential subplots here. You've got Rebecca. You've got the character who I have a lot of sympathy for, who would like to be able to use his own body. You've got a potential antagonist. You've got the shades. I think there's more than enough to keep going. Or if you want to contract it, that's certainly possible, too.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, and I didn't mean to imply I guess I kind of did how I said that. But yes, that's an excellent point. Mm-hmm. So you know, maybe as an exercise, I don't know, try writing it as a short story and see how it goes out, and see what those areas where you're flexing and going, oh God, I need to pad this. I need more here. Mm-hmm. And see, find out where those points are. And that's obviously a point where you'll have a lot more emotional juice to invest in those story elements, and that might serve as a signpost for you. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a very good point, actually. I'm going to take that into serious consideration.
foregoing the assumption that Michelle was murdered and then reincarnated by someone. And did I miss that from the story pitch? Because, Rachel, man, you went right to that, and that was a very cool idea. Was that in the story pitch at all, or was that just she's been reincarnated and, Rachel, you were filling in the blanks?
I got the impression that someone would have reincarnated her, but I'm not sure that that is actually in the pitch, Ryan.
Yeah, Ryan.
Not specifically. I mean, I'm again being very loose with a lot of this because I need to kind of solidify it in my own mind. So, yeah.
Did you have something in mind for why Michelle was reincarnated?
No. And that's that kind of keeping in mind that I had assumed up until about 10 minutes ago that the there was a person doing this to her. I had assumed that as I learned who he was, I would learn why he would do that.
Okay. And is Michelle the only one who's ever reincarnated ever?
Proper reincarnation, yes. I will probably explore that if I feel like info dumping, but I'm also a fan of leaving some things to the ether, and I might not ever explain that.
Well, if she's the only person ever, like in all time in history, then whatever's reincarnating her has to be super important.
Exactly.
A super powerful person, like it's going to change the stakes
you're
working with.
Or she's a messiah of some kind. I mean, maybe her instincts as to... I'm not dead. I can't be dead. I had so much to live for. Come not from, you know, just the youthful vigor and drive of an intelligent teenager, but the fact of a deeper instinct that I am here to do something important. She could be here. There are many myths about how death came to the world, and that it was all in many of them. It was a mistake. Or a shortcoming of the trickster god, or something along those lines. But the notion that humans should die was something that was added later to the mix. And I'll just put this on the table. What if Michelle is the first step to healing that, which is why the Shades are so pissed off?
That's a very valid point. At one point, I did toy around with the idea that the... how do I word this? The antagonist to the story was actually Michelle. Because she could, in theory, if I were willing to go that route, be the person that reincarnates herself.
Charlie could be the storyteller for Michelle's story.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be his perspective and, you know, they can share whatever. I put that on the table. Now that changes the whole shape of the story.
Yeah. And it also adds, maybe, I'm not sure about this, but I think it has the potential to add a lot of religious implications, which I am admittedly going to shy away from if I can. I know I can't entirely, but I want to try and to keep that to a minimum if I can, again, because I don't want to make commentary or seem like I'm making commentary on religion when that's not my focus, if that makes sense. I hope it does. Yeah.
Well, Rachel, one of the reasons that we paired you up with Ryan for Ryan's story was because you've written several stories that deal with the dead or the afterlife, and dodged the religion bullet, of those stories very, very handily and very, elegantly. Can you speak to that a little bit for Ryan as far as things? Can he do that? Can he tell a tale like this and not bring in religion and faith?
Totally. I think it's easily possible. I mean, actually, if you really think about it, all fantasy has implications that are religious whenever you're adding magic to the world. We'll just think about it more with afterlife stuff. I am an atheist and I was raised without religion, so it's not really my default way of thinking about the world. It might be trickier for you. I think just kind of like making up your own rules, just not referencing it should get you there. There's a lot of science fiction that's about the afterlife. I think if you don't go out of your way to invoke it, you should be okay. We don't have lots of like cross symbolism or anything.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
I want to jump in.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm gonna.
All right, get it.
I kind of okay. So here's where I'm coming from because it's a little bit different. I don't want it to go into someone else who has some power to bring somebody back from the dead, or you know, like you were saying about wanting to avoid the religious aspect or something along those lines. So I'm almost wondering if maybe It could be something as simple as Michelle has a little sister who believes her to still be alive. And as a child, that belief is so strong, like children's belief in Santa Claus and, you know, all of those kinds of things. And as we get older, we start to become disillusioned. And so that may be like her belief that her sister is still alive is so strong that that's what brings her back. And that's what gives Charlie the realization of what is keeping him pinned if he doesn't already know. And then he would start to realize that his daughter is maybe moving into adulthood, and that's why that pin is weakening as she's becoming disillusioned. And all of that realization can come from this, the fact that this, you know, this 4 or 5-year-old so adamantly believes that her sister is still alive and that it actually brought her back.
I think that raises a couple interesting things. One is that the way he could discover that his pin is weakening is he could be attacked by the shades.
Yes, nice.
But the other thing is, if little kids can bring people back, they do it a lot.
Yeah, I was
gonna say the same thing. That's true, yeah.
Buffer there.
Yeah.
I see this as an adventure novel with lots of plot reversals and stuff. So that's actually pretty counter to what David was saying.
Sure.
You've talked about having a clock, and that made me think about if he needs to have more time, and he needs to have more time, and what's limiting the time is that Rebecca is coming to terms with the fact that he's dead, it would be really hard for him, and thus really cool to make him do, if the way he could get more time was to convince Rebecca he's still alive.
Oh, that's so harsh.
That is, yeah, I like that. As soon as you mentioned the clock and started talking about that, I went, oh, that's where she's going? That's gnarly, yeah.
That's cruel and wicked. And you know, actually, and let's go ahead and talk about that. The fact that he doesn't tell Rebecca that he's dead, I don't see that as a noble step.
No.
I see that as a cruel thing to do to his daughter, to let her go on in her anguish and folly of believing that he's alive when he's not.
But if it's for the greater good...
Is it though?
And it may be, you know, it's the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the, this is basic Star Trek, Dave.
Oh, sure. Invoke the mighty Trek. Fine.
No, but I love it. Like I love that concept of, because the one person that he doesn't want to hurt is his daughter, but it's the one person that he has to in order to achieve his goal. I think that's fabulous.
That's a lovely gray area. Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. And then I have to throw this in just because I have to, but maybe the body that he's in, like if it died the second that he jumps back into it, and so the other soul hasn't had a chance to get out yet, it can start to deteriorate, and then we even have kind of a zombie thing going on.
Yeah, also a thought, but I don't think I described it well, but I love the idea of having that other soul in there saying, like, hey, who the hell are you, and how come you have the ability to move my body and I don't?
Totally.
And then having that character, that soul, also have these kind of noble, ignoble fights.
See, guy needs to be on the character list, Rye.
You know what? He came up at the last minute because I kept thinking, I'll just throw Charlie into a body and he'll go about his business. And then I thought, you know what? Like, I had toyed around when I was a child about the idea that multiple personality disorder was actually too many souls in one body. And then,
love it.
Yeah, this sort of just all, you know, lines. Next thing you know, I started thinking maybe this guy's more important than just a husk. I mean, I even used the word husk in the original draft or synopsis, and I'm thinking that's not an appropriate term because he's really not that.
Yeah, right. And I was joking about the zombie thing.
What was that, Rachel?
Awesome to have him be in there and be kind of like, I want my body back. And if Charlie leaves, is he going to die? Is his body going to be stuck again? Is he going to be stuck awake in a comatose body? There's lots of character torture moments there. I think it is too convenient for him to be the antagonist. I think having him be a gray character is a good idea. I think swinging too hard either way is going to be annoying. It come across as moral preaching in some way. Mm-hmm. And just remembering that he can introduce other complications to the plot too.
Yes.
Like be like, okay, we can go talk to Michelle, but afterward we're going to my apartment and we're calling my ex-girlfriend. And then like, that's other ways to bring in plot, other ways to bring in conflicts with time and conflicts with people and emotional conflicts.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and going back to your theme of the importance of taking action against fate, I mean, this this guy is being given a second chance, basically. The guy that who's Charlie, the guy, God, where are my pronouns? The guy whose body Charlie is inhabiting, the owner of the body, is being given the opportunity to do exactly that. And you know, there's that wonderful conflict of, you know, you're trying to accomplish your goals. Why can't I accomplish mine? And mm-hmm. and have Charlie be confronted with the fact that, yeah, why not? Why am I doing that? Because it's important. Sure. Why?
Yeah, and I like that because it speaks to this. I've been doing a lot of research lately on the concept of the antagonist and what are they. And I think we've all echoed this statement before that the antagonist isn't this mustache-twirling villain, right. but rather is a character who should have motivations that are strictly contrary to the main character, to the protagonist. And so I keep thinking to myself that I'll have an antagonist on my hand when I can take this story and literally flip it around and write it the other way, and it's still... resonates. And for this guy, the more we talk about him, the more I'm realizing I might have that here already. He may be my Charlie's antagonist, but only because I've chosen Charlie as my protagonist. In another world, I could easily write this book the other way. In fact, in a crazy world, I would.
Sure. An antagonist of circumstance.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, yeah,
not just the antagonist. So he wouldn't be the person who had somehow caused the world to be unraveled.
Right. Yeah. That's too easy for me. And it's just too much, you know, haha, we're all in the same room at the end with a gun with one bullet pointed at each other. I don't like that at all. And I think it takes the sympathy away from that character who's got that comatose body.
Right.
But it's,
me,
you know.
Tell me about the economy of the shades. Specifically, how is it that what Charlie does with spirits, sending them on to the afterlife by convincing them that they're dead, how is what Charlie does different from what the shades do by tormenting and ripping and tearing them? Are they going into the same afterlife? And what do the shades get out of that exchange?
Okay, the first part of that, do they go to the afterlife, to the same afterlife, is intentionally, the answer is nobody knows. Because I would like to think that we know as much about the midlife in life as the midlife knows about the afterlife.
Gotcha.
So okay. we don't know. Charlie doesn't know. What he does know is that when a shade does show up and start torturing a soul, it is literal mental torture designed to trick the soul into thinking they're dead or wishing they were dead.
Okay.
And having them move on. So he's just trying to take a humane goal to the exact same end, which is a very good point.
It goes against every world-building bone in my body, but I'll let it go. So that's cool.
It's okay.
Sorry, it invites a problem, which is that if they don't know what's happening to the spirits who pass on from the midlife, then it becomes no more necessarily morally justified for Charlie to be helping people pass on than it would be for us to be helping people pass on.
That's a good point.
So I think there's got to be some knowledge.
He becomes the spiritual Kevorkian.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. No, I have a solution.
Oh, go, Bri.
Okay. So what if the shades are people who were pinned to the midlife too long?
Ooh.
And the longer that you spend there, the more of yourself you lose. And so the only thing that they know is what, like, the maybe you can strengthen your, you know, your ability to not fade away or whatever. Oh. But or you feel closer to the afterlife the more people that you send there, but the shades have been there for too long, and so they've lost a lot of their humanity, and all that they have left is the pain of being there and being stuck in between worlds.
Okay, let me riff on that for just a second. And Rye, this could be one of those, this is complete bullshit. Just set it aside.
Right,
but
yeah, okay.
You had mentioned that poltergeists somehow help Charlie into a body.
Yeah.
I was going to ask for details about that, but let me offer you this. Okay, let me pin together a bunch of things. First of all, Charlie's not the only one who's pinned. So there must be a culture of these unpinned beings that they run across. Not must be, but let's say that there is, that as you wander through the midlife, you encounter other pinned individuals, and over time, there would be a culture, a club. It might be three people, it might be 3,000. Who knows how many pinned individuals there are. Mm-hmm. But they could be anything. They could be the police force. They could be just nice guys who are trying to help people out. What Rachel was talking about is an excellent point as far as defining some sort of moral ground between that distinguishes one or the other or not. But what if that the way Charlie gets into his body into this body is by having these pinned individuals basically sacrifice themselves, giving Charlie's spirit enough weight and tangibility to reconnect in some way with the material world, that they have to give up their existence on the midlife, render it to Charlie so that he can have enough corporeality. Oh yeah, I'm making this shit up as I go. to reconnect with a body. Therefore, and what if, taking what Brian said, if the pinned guys have been around too long, what if these guys are trying to consume these souls and become real themselves? And in the past, this has happened, that these dark shade-like souls have actually come into our world and manifested as dark forces, serial killers. I mean, I don't know how supernatural you want to go in terms of the transition into the real world, but, you know, the notion of the shades being able now to cross into our world and wreak havoc creates an even more tangible danger. I don't know. Does that resonate at all with you?
Some of it does, but I think it speaks back to something that Rachel said that's kind of, it's got me hung up a bit now, because I think it's the same problem, which is, if I were pinned to the midlife and I could lend my weight to someone else, thereby, you know, resolving my own story in whatever way, why wouldn't I have done that already? I'm a little hung up on that concept that was brought up.
Like, that would be a highly noble act, though.
But if it turns you into a shade that then is permanently stuck in the midlife, that would be a sacrifice.
Right. Wait, so you're saying that if a midlifer, pinned midlifer, gives over his soul to someone else so they can re-engage, that they become a shade?
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
You know, I would handle this by having the midlifers who end up pinned, first of all, maybe some of them do that, and that's how you get rid of all the noble ones. are kind of like, you know, maybe they all become jaded, and they're all kind of a little cowardly, and, you know, they're like, but I'm going to stay here. I know what this place is, and in this place, because nobody else really knows what's going on besides the pinned people, I'm king of whatever economy is here.
Yes, exactly.
I'm at the market. I had a couple of notes. One thing is for... I really like the idea for especially young female characters who are potentially sacrifices to get like asked about it, but she could say no, and Charlie could be like, actually, I'm going to kill you anyway. But at least that brings in Michelle having some agency.
Yeah. And that's, sorry, can I yes, wrap on that for a sec? Yeah. Cause I think that's very important to me. And that's something I've been thinking a lot about in my writing is, even just in general, the assignment of gender, I want to start messing with that more. I admittedly, because I am a 32-year-old male, will probably spend most of my next year writing 32-year-old male protagonists because I get them. But I don't want to write characters that fall into a trope, or a stereotype if I can avoid it.
I'm going to give you my next piece of advice, which is to gender flip two of the characters.
And I really, really thought about doing that. Yeah. Keep going. I want to hear more.
Well, what you've got is two young female characters who are innocent in some way, Rebecca and Michelle, mm-hmm. and two older male characters who are not, which is Charlie and the person who was comatose, who does not have a name.
Right.
I would change the person who's comatose, and I would change Rebecca. Rebecca's a son, and he ends up in a woman's body.
Interesting.
Obviously, that's just me.
No, it is interesting, and I'm...
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Well, and that brings in a whole different dynamic between if it's Charlie and his son, you know, there's the whole paternal instinct there. Oh, man. Yeah. As we all sit back and whirl on that for a little bit. Nicely done, Rachel. Well played, ma'am.
I'd be a little, and of course, you know, I'm obviously not of the experience that Rachel is. My caution or my hesitance with putting him then into a woman's body is then it gives me the feel of a lot of 80s and 90s movies that came out that dealt with, you know, like a white man and a black man chained together. And then it was all about the breaking of stereotypes instead of telling a good story. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's also you have to be really careful about not doing that.
Right. Those are bad. I think that
right.
you avoid that is to not be bad, which is terrible.
Excellent advice.
Anytime like a male character goes into a female character, it's like, yeah, now I have boobs. Like, and like, it could be a female character that he's not attracted to. That would be shocking. Like, I think if you just are like, here are the stereotypes, but those don't matter, I'm going to write actual characters, then you can get out of that trap. But it is sure. something that you'll have to think about, because there are a lot of movies about yeah. guys and girls' bodies, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I just mean, like, from a reader, from an audience's point of view, that would be my first, you know, because it has become a trope, that idea of a person of one gender stuck in another person, or a person of another gender's body. And so as an audience member, my first gut reaction is, oh, great, here we go. And then I might be pleasantly surprised, but, you know, it's just that initial reaction right away because yeah, so many bad ones have been done.
But you could work around that. I mean, I think that would be a challenge for Rye. But
sure.
I think Rachel's point is well taken, that by staring that trope in the face, we might actually be able to explore some new ground in terms of how Charlie deals with his situation, plus keeping in mind that he's been dead for a very long
time. That's what I was going to say. Like, there's something that I want to keep in mind here is that one of the key components here is that, you know, I refer to the fact that Charlie has to learn how to blink and all that stuff again. And I feel like if you've been without a body for 20 years, then does a woman's body or a man's body have the same connotation to someone who goes straight from one to the other? Yeah. And I kind of feel like this is a good opportunity for me to challenge that trope by almost literally not addressing it at all and saying he's in a body and it's a woman. But other than that, it's inconsequential. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a body with a soul in it, and the gender of that soul and that body are not, you know, drivers.
I explore it. I think it's definitely, I think it's a rich area to delve into.
Yeah.
And as you explore that character and that circumstance, God, just go explore. Well,
it's neat. We're talking about this too. I've had this thought a lot lately that, and maybe I'm wrong, this is just more of a general thing, but in theory, I could take a story, any story. This one would be a great example to use in the context of this conversation. And just randomly almost assign gender where it doesn't matter. Right.
Sure.
I mean, doesn't that really speak to the concept that gender doesn't matter if that's what I'm gunning for?
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, unless you're writing a story specifically about gender. I think that if you did decide to keep the comatose victim male, as a reader, I would want to see another female character. Like, maybe there would be a cast of five and there could be, I don't know, a pinned female character who he has to interact with in the midlife or something like that, who's
absolutely
not an innocent kid. And that would make me happier as a feminist reader.
Yeah, and you know, it's cool that you mentioned that too, because I'm starting to think now, why did I decide that Michelle was a girl at all? That has no bearing on the story whatsoever. So there's no reason she couldn't be a boy.
Although there is such a thing as gender roles.
Yeah.
And I can see him having a harder time deciding to kill her if she's a girl than if she's a boy.
Like, good old-fashioned chivalry kicks in?
Yeah. Well, kind of, yeah. I mean, it is part of our culture, whether we want to deny it or not, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's just kind of my feel on it.
No, and that's a great point, too, because, I mean, again, why is his daughter the one that pins him? Why isn't his son? And for me, that knee-jerk reaction is to say, you know, it's the old trope of daddy's little girl. It just seems like that sort of father-daughter relationship is more commonly referred to as a stronger one, at least in the vernacular, than the father-son relationship can be.
The effects that you afflicted Rebecca with in her young adult life of lack of commitment, trust issues, abandonment issues, obviously, because her mother lied and said Charlie went away, not that he died.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, and there are those assumptions as well, you know, and I don't want to close this discussion line because this is good stuff, but I keep going back to something Rachel said about giving Michelle more agency. And I'm going to keep working with the characters as presented, even though the gender flipping issue is definitely still on the table and intriguing. But I'd like to see if we can find a way to give Michelle more agency in the story than what she has, for lack of a better word.
As would I.
So, if she's reincarnated by someone else, and I've got nowhere to go with this, I'm just bringing attention back to that. She's reincarnated by somebody else, and that person has an agenda. I don't know. Anybody feel free to jump in if ideas or inspiration.
Yeah, I got a random idea. So somehow her little brother, who's like 12, accidentally is the one who killed her. I'm thinking right now, which is stupid, of like a monk episode or something where they got killed by a lawnmower. I don't know. Whatever. So I think it's Medium. Anyway.
Yes, it was.
Somehow the 12-year-old kid, he takes the car out for a joyride. He runs over his sister. This is the worst thing that's ever happened in his life. And he somehow figures out a way to bring her back to life. She knows. At some point in the novel, she finds out that that's what's happened. And she refuses to kill herself because she is protecting her brother. Who she knows is going to have to go through everything he already went through. And then she's the antagonist because she's the one directly working against Charlie. I mean, there are lots of, I think, ideas like that where you can put her in direct conflict with Charlie. Unfortunately, it doesn't work for him to recruit her onto his team because then she could just kill herself.
Yeah, and that's, I was going to say that. I don't like the idea of her even being comfortable with that idea because I want her to be a strong character who isn't just, you know, oh, bummer, I died, that sucks. Well, I'm not supposed to be here, guys, so I'm going to head back now. Like, no, she could see this very easily as this, you know, this is the fate I'm supposed to have, not being dead, but having been there and now being back. I'm not giving this back up. This is my second shot.
Yeah.
So I'd have a hard time selling myself on the idea that she would be willing to participate in pretty much anything Charlie was doing.
Yeah. And I think that if she met Charlie in the midlife, she should know, like, have some ability to see that it's him regardless of what body he's in and know that he came back for her so that she has, you know, the conscious decision to run, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know what
that's,
I mean?
That's a very good point, actually, yeah, because I haven't considered the fact
that... I kind of like this. Just again, from the more literary and less genre standpoint of you know, how do you convince someone, you know... Yeah, it makes perfect sense that Michelle would not want to go back, that she would not make the noble sacrifice, which makes me wonder about the effect on the midlife of her reincarnation. I know you said that no one's ever done this before, but let's riff on Rachel's idea for a second of her little brother finding a dusty tome or invoking something that allows it to happen. That would imply that it existed at one point in the distant past, that at some point this did happen. Maybe that's where the shades came from. Maybe this violation, this reverse murder, is what caused the shades to happen in the first place. And when Michelle is drawn back, again, this whole, instead of this, the shades suddenly turning ravenous, more of them exist, and there's an impact on the ecosystem. What this does is it stops the shades of destroying the midlife being the primary issue here. And makes it more gray, more nebulous, and the notion that, yes, we have to go get Michelle and we have to make things right, and then having to confront the idea of, oh, my God, how do I do this? And how do you engage that? Does that resonate at all?
The second part, 100%. The first part, 95%, because I feel like I wanted to finish that sentence you started, which is, you know, oh, my God, Michelle's been reincarnated, and if I don't go back and do something about it, then insert... thing here.
Insert that, crisis.
Insert, yeah, that's what I need is I need a reason to, I always have this in my stories and maybe that's a bad thing for me, but I always have that that moment when he's sitting in a chair sipping tea or something and all of a sudden he realizes he's got to stand up in slow motion and go and do something instead of not do something. And it's always a very extreme trigger.
Sure.
Now that might not have to be the case in this situation, but what would make a guy that has existed in the midlife for 20 years suddenly decide to take an action that clearly he knows about and could have taken all along? I feel like I need that environmental crisis that, you know, Kansas is going to get blown away in this tornado of shades, for lack of a better way to put it.
In response to that, he has friends among the pinned. Mm-hmm. So, the girl is reincarnated. That causes, first, I'm going with the idea that shades are somehow vitiated souls. you lose all your personality because you were there too long. And the shades can eat you and turn you into one of them. And so there's kind of this pest problem where you're trying to keep the population of shades low. When Michelle is reincarnated, that generates a lot more shades. It vitiates many people. But it also takes energy away from the spirit world for every day she's still alive. So as long as she's still alive, more and more people are being turned into shades. And one thing that could happen to Charlie would be if he loses somebody or people that he has come to know, even if not care about deeply, they become shades. He could be like, I need to stop this process from continuing to happen if you cause him to suffer a loss.
Yeah, I can see this black sucking hole in the midlife that is drawing in spirits and eviscerating them, and they become shades and it becomes this wasteland. And that's the very place Charlie needs to go back into the world to find Michelle.
Well, it's interesting. This brought up another thought too. And again, I didn't have a lot of real estate to delve into the world building component here. So allow me to just ramble for one quick second. I always pictured the midlife, like physically, what does the spirit world look like? And I always liked the idea that it was gray tones and sound was muted and smell wasn't quite right. And I like to describe it to my friends when I talk about this, that there is traffic, there are cars on roads, but there aren't drivers in cars. What the midlife is it's a physical manifestation of the thoughts of the people that are there. So people think of traffic, therefore there is traffic, but there aren't people in cars. So as these souls get swiped, there are less people inflicting that mental projection of physicality on the midlife. Therefore, it's not so much a black sucking hole as it's all just fading away. What do you think about that?
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that too, yeah.
As long as that can be conveyed in an effective way so that it becomes a goad, a black sucking hole is a highly visible, holy crap, we gotta do something about that.
Right.
Having things fade away, and again, as the writer, I'm sure you can do that. So,
yes. Well, and it's a washing away of the bridge.
Yeah.
You know, without midlife, can they get to the afterlife?
Yeah.
And then what happens on Earth? You know.
I still like the idea of physical manifestations of shades in addition.
Sure.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yes. Well, and another thing, and this is one of those, you can throw it into the bullshit category ideas, but what if Rebecca or Robert or whatever, you know, whichever gender you decide to go with the son or daughter, has a terminal disease, which would up the time or the ticking clock that he has to take care of all this, because if that bridge goes away, and then his child dies and he's not there to take them across. I don't know.
Yeah, I toyed with that idea, but I had two little quick issues.
Okay.
Yeah. The first one was that I felt like if it was a terminal disease, then it took the opportunity for him to make the wrong choice out of his hands.
Yeah.
Okay. The wrong choice being telling her the truth. And the second issue was it felt too easy to have her untimely terminal disease
right
coming to a head at the same time he decides to come back.
Yeah, it does feel a bit contrived.
Okay. Yeah. Let me try this on Dave. For size.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. The person whose body could be about to die too. So that person would have a great motivation to make sure that the midlife continues to exist.
Sure.
Say that one more time.
Well, it wouldn't be convenient to have the person whose body he's in be about to die because they started out comatose in the first place.
Right.
So they could feel it as a ticking clock if the midlife disappears, that they are going to disappear.
Okay.
Yeah. And sorry, Dave.
No, please go ahead.
Subverting you. But if that's the case, then, you know, you also, now you have a whole new conflict where it's not just, oh, you can control my body and I can't, you bastard. It's you are killing me faster because everything that you're doing, whatever was killing me in the first place, everything that you're doing is doing damage to me. And you're shortening my life in addition to the fact that I can't control my own body and you can.
You know what? It is hilarious that you guys are mentioning this because it never crossed my mind that he was in, I always pictured him laying in a hospital and then Charlie pops in there and stands him up and walks him out the bloody door. And all I can think of now is he was there for a reason.
Yep.
Wow. It also potentially puts the comatose person at odds with Charlie. If Charlie at some point is like, you know, I really can't kill Michelle, and the person whose body's in like, yes, you can.
What has all this been for?
Fuck you, right?
Exactly.
You know what? The original ending I was going to go with was exactly that. Charlie approaches Michelle, realizes that's the decision he's supposed to be making, but has never crossed his mind. He can't do it. And the guy in that body says, really, you jerk? You brought me this far. We fought all this way and you can't do this. And this is going to get me what I want, which is you out of my damn body. I'll do it. And that's the moment when finally the strength of will kicks in and that comatose person does the deed.
That's taking primary agency away from Charlie as well.
Exactly.
I mean, totally have that in there. I just think you might need another couple reversals around it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was wondering, Dave, did you have something that you've been trying to say for like 10 minutes?
Yes, actually. And thank you. I'll make it quick. Ryan, I had the exact same vision of the spirit world that you have of midlife, that being echoes and reflections of people's perceptions, beliefs, passions. Those emotional ties and connections to things and other people resonate and reflect in, let's call it the midlife. Mm-hmm. So what you've got is terrain. You've got topography, but it's distorted, Escher-esque, Dali-esque, by the distorting elements of emotion and passion, whether it be, you know, rage or love or utter loathing. But whatever has strong emotional ties has a doppelganger, has an analog somewhere in the midlife. And Charlie has been wandering familiar haunts. Wherever he lived in his real life, he's found those places that have their analog in the midlife and is lurking and lingering and falling into that rut, that taking action against fate type of thing that you're describing. He's doing the exact opposite of that. And while he's there, there's a doppelganger, a resonant image of Rebecca or whoever his sibling is who believes he's alive. And he's stalking her and following her around in the midlife. He can't touch her. He can't even necessarily see her. He just senses her and follows her around. And so you've got this culture, this distorted reflection of 1990s America or whatever, that's recreated in this sort of bizarre Escher-esque world, of shades and specters and passions and emotions. And what if the owner of the body, what if comatose people have a special sort of one foot in the midlife connection, and Charlie and this owner know each other? And part of the reason that Charlie goes into the owner's body is that they have some sort of connection and can now somehow resolve either a conflict or an alliance of some kind, so that now that they are actually in the same world, literally in the same body, then whatever drama they've been building up over their relationship in the midlife now comes to a head. And then you can layer on top of that Michelle's thing and dealing with Rebecca and yada, yada, yada. But bleh, there.
Interesting. That brings up a couple of interesting thoughts, because I mean I haven't talked about how Charlie died, and that's gonna have to come up at some point.
Yeah.
And mentally I've always pictured it as a, you know, because I am Canadian, a plane crash. Yeah, he's eaten by a bear that was covered right in maple syrup.
Yep.
So
choked on some bacon. Got it.
Yeah. A plane crash, because you know that happens a lot in the heavily wooded areas of Canada. And I'm, you know, enthralled with Alberta and these areas that are just long forests that have no end. And if he was in a plane crash, he probably had a co-pilot.
Sure.
And, you know, you can infer from that what you will. But that's kind of, you know, when you started talking about that, I thought that's an interesting point. I'd have to do some research to find out, you know, how long can a body live in that state? And is he really comatose or just paralyzed?
Yeah. Or he had a near-death experience. I mean, you know, and if you want to go that route, then those people have one foot in the midlife and are privy to information through that distorted connection.
And it does solve an interesting problem I just thought of too, which is, you know, if Charlie were to go into a random person's comatose body, how the heck did he know where to find that?
Yeah. You know, what mm-hmm. why?
Oh, that's what magic is for.
So, Rachel, thank you for yielding the floor for me before I had a stroke. You were in the process of exploring another idea. Did you want to go into that a little bit?
Sure. Well, I to follow on what you were saying, I'd like the idea of him coming into the body of somebody he already has some relationship with, although I also really like the idea of some stranger being like, what the hell? Who are you? This might be cliche, but if we're talking about ways in which Charlie has to sacrifice, like what the end of the novel is for him. Killing somebody he doesn't want to kill is a thing. Mm-hmm. But if by then he really knows he has to, if Michelle is the antagonist, I'm wondering if she can threaten him with something over his head. Like, she can be threatening to kill Rebecca. That might be totally, I think that's pretty cliche. She could have access through her brother to some of this magic book or whatever. And she could know how to turn him into a shade and be like, you know, if you kill me, I'm going to actually delete your soul from the universe.
Sure.
You know, I think they're,
Or she could want that power and do what was done to her to other people and just really mess with the whole order of things. She could become an antagonist of sorts.
I just think that you might want to think about more costs for Charlie.
Yeah, you're right. I really do. And I like the idea of someone threatening Rebecca to influence him. I'm not sure I'm comfortable with the idea of it being Michelle, but that doesn't mean I'm not uncomfortable with the idea of it being whoever, if it is a person, brought her back.
Right.
Because obviously he or she did that for a reason. So if I assume it's a brother, and you know, that brings a whole host of other issues if I make it a 12-year-old boy or something. I mean, what kind of... I've long wanted to try exploring the themes of what is right and wrong to a 12-year-old boy, or you know, to a child, you know? Like,
there you go. Sure.
Could you take someone else's life to protect your sister when it's got the innocence of I'm protecting my sister? It's not about killing. It's about saving.
Sure.
Well,
and Rachel's idea is rich because, you know, when Michelle first goes into the midlife, she and Charlie could be talking. They could be friends and sharing things. And Charlie can tell her about Rebecca. And then when she's reincarnated and gets a taste of that power, I mean, again, going back to your theme of the importance of taking action against fate,
mm-hmm.
How about taking right action against fate? You know, maybe Michelle is saying, I am never doing that again. I am never going to die again. And I am going to become immortal and nothing's going to stop me from doing it. And having Charlie be the only one who can stop her from doing so and thus just perverting the cycle of life. That's just very tasty in terms of what Michelle can then bring to bear against Charlie to thwart him.
Mm-hmm.
Guys, I hate to invoke the ticking clock, but our time is running out. I'd like to go around the table one more time and just give Ryan some final thoughts, some suggestions, some guidance as he moves forward with the rest of this project. Rachel, start us off.
I think this is really cool. I think you need to take some time and write an outline, although that might just be because I'm an outliner and it sounds like you are too. So,
yeah. You
know, give yourself a while and then go back into the text, you know, even if it takes a few weeks or a couple months to get that down.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. I appreciate that. Yeah, I will do that.
Brian?
Yeah, the only thing that I want to throw out there is for me personally, I don't know that I want to see... too much earthly magic. Someone else who finds a book and is able to bring her back. I almost think like that will distract from the value of the characters that you have in this. But again, that's just me. But I'm so like plot centered usually and not character driven, and I'm like, give me a good plot over character any day. But in this case, I'm totally the opposite, and I think that what you can do with these characters is just awesome, and I'm really looking forward to what you do with it. So
awesome.
Good job.
Thanks.
Yeah,
definitely. And I'm totally with Brian in that, you know, if you've listened to any of our shows, we're all about the plot, and it takes a guest author. Thank you, Rachel, for bringing us around to the character side of things. But Brian's absolutely right. Ryan, you've got a character story here, and it's beautiful in that respect.
Yeah.
I'm going to come down on the other side of Brian and say that I think if nothing else, Rachel's work has demonstrated that you can have those magical elements that serve as not MacGuffins, but as glittery elements that you are there and facilitate this next stage, and away you go. And it doesn't have to be a big plot-driven thing. It could be the ancient tome of Agamotto, and that's all we hear about it, and that's fine because that's not what the story's about. But again, that's just another perspective of things. We don't have these kind of discussions, Ryan, unless there's meat here.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
this is sweet. We could do this all
night. It's meaty. Yes. Right
on. So, Ryan, I will tell you that, we have a policy here at the Roundtable where when this story becomes a tangible reality and it goes out into Amazon or whatever and acquires the huge accolades it's destined for, we will have you back and we will make you a knight of the round table.
Oh, wow.
Yes, we shall Sir anoint Ryan. You Sir Ryan, and we will right. post your picture on our Hall of Knights, and we will sing your accolades to the heavens.
Oh, that's huge.
So, yes, there's a carrot right there.
Wow, yeah, no kidding. That's not a carrot. That's like the carrot, man.
The carrot. And it's a legitimate thing because this is the round table. We can do that.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
That's
awesome. Rachel, thank you so much for informing this discussion so eloquently and with such a rich perspective. You are exactly the reason why we do this and bring on authors with experience and skill at this. So we are deeply grateful for you taking the time and helping Ryan out as you have.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thanks. It was a lot of fun. And Ryan, when you finish this, ping me about it so I can see what you do.
Okay. I will do that. Thank you so much.
And Ryan, thank you, man. This stuff doesn't happen, and it's never easy to put your baby out there for discussion. we know that, and we're always grateful when writers step up to do that. So, molto grazie, signore.
Right on. Well, I appreciate you guys letting me ramble about this. It was really a great experience, and I've enjoyed the poop out of it.
Classic round table. Poop all over. And gold. Poop and gold.
Poop and gold. Yeah. Gold poop.
Oh, jeez. Brian, holy crap, man, another awesome episode. My mind is reeling.
Your mind is reeling. I gotta work in the morning and I'm not going to bed.
Got stuff to do, man.
I got work to do now.
Final thoughts, Bri?
I loved it, and so I'm glad that you brought it to us, and I hope that that we were able to give you something to work with.
This, as long as we're doling out gratitude, friends, as always, thank you for tuning in. We are deeply appreciative of that. Feel free to spread the word to the world of the podcast. That's probably the best thing. That's like buying us all, not only coffee, but also scones. That's coffee and scones for Brian and I, and we would greatly appreciate that because we love coffee and scones.
Oh, yeah.
Go out to iTunes, leave a review, post a comment. We have a rich history now of listeners, Ryan, posting up additional ideas or new thoughts regarding the story ideas on the website. And I'll give you a shout when those comments go up so we can continue the discussion there. And of course, send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Friends, as awesome as it has been, in just a few days, it starts all over again. New guest hosts, new guest writers, new ideas to explore and unwrap like Christmas packages for everyone's delight. So until then, Brian, what should our dear guests and friends should be doing?
They should go write.
Go write. Yes, absolutely. And look for awesomeness because you find what you're looking for. Thank you so much, friends. Until we meet again, stay cool, stay frosty, and we will talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.